Hello, pals. Apologies for the tardiness of this episode. In the past, I've been able to blame it on late nights driving back from gigs or early mornings because of my children, but this one can be blamed solely upon my misunderstanding of the calendar and inability to count. I'd like to say it was even due to a leap year, but it wasn't even that. I hold my hands up, and this time, you have outfoxed me. So, now that it is in your podcatcher of choice, I hope you enjoy it. Mara was a belter of a guest, and she brought all sorts of daft suggestions along to our tales of world's worst improvisations. Just to say, as ever, if you want to get in touch, you can get in touch at worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. And if you would like to keep the lights on here at Worst Foot Forward Towers, then head to patreon.com/worstfootforward. We've had a couple of recent donors who have suggested cracking topics, which we are going to find some guests for. We've got the world's worst building material going to be recorded soon, and something we're very excited about, world's worst dragon, which I reckon we're going to get an old friend back on the show for that one. So if you want to get stuck into that, head to Patreon and set us some homework. But for now, it is time to say yes and to this week's episode. Welcome, friends, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you join me surrounded by well-meaning Canadians wearing plaid shirts and chinos, all jumping around pretending to be Napoleon Bonaparte riding a unicycle in a film noir, and Cleopatra's pet snake being voiced by a crazed sock puppet. Am I in an improv group, or have I just taken mushrooms in a Toronto suburb? It's up to you to guess. And with me is the second to my city, the loose to my moose, and the yes to my and. It's Barry McStay. Stay.
No, but I'm not.
You absolute monster.
No, I'm not. I'm a person.
This is blackboard nails down the blackboard of my soul. Stop it immediately.
No, it's not. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I think me and Mara are about to do a citizen's euthanasia on you, unless you cease this unskilled improv immediately.
The lovely thing is that we've all been in improv groups, and I think improv is now well enough established that there is a wider cultural understanding of improv in jokes and like what to do and what not to do, thanks to, you know, Whose Line Is It Anyway and SNL and 30 Rock and all of those things. So what's your favorite improv moment? I realize recreating them is always instantly death, but do you have any very fond memories from your improv days?
My two favourites is the very first year I took an improv show to the Fringe, and this is a group that in our first year got a 1-star review and the words "no artistic merit whatsoever," and the following year from the same publication got a 5-star review and "the greatest improv show I have ever seen." And let me say, neither of those are true, but I mean, my favourite moment there was post-show when the cabaret show, the burlesque show, Falling Us, came in, and it was loads of winsome girls wearing horses' heads, so that was quite fun. But when one of our hosts came forward and went, friends, please can we have a suggestion for a household object, and someone from the back of the room yelled no, and the host went, thank you very much, the suggestion will be negativity, and then we did an improv scene all around antimatter.
Amazing.
I was very lucky to work with Andrew Hunter Murray, mm-hmm. Of course the now host of No Such Thing as the Fish and arch enemy of Worst Foot Forward. But I remember being in one of his early scenes as a new improviser, and the scene was chasing a penguin through the Arctic on a snowmobile, having a lot of fun, and then the penguin got injured, and so we got off the snowmobile, and one of the person in the scene went, Professor, is the penguin okay? And because Andrew is instinctively hilarious, his gut reaction was to hold a hand out as though the penguin were 50 foot tall and go, I think it's going to be all right. And just that comedy nudge to like take us to a wonderful alternate world.
What a silly man.
What a silly man. What about you?
I was in an improv group in university, as most men who go on to host podcasts were. And and we called ourselves Improv She Wrote, which was the result of a 4-hour brainstorming session. And we had a lot of very fun gigs in the theatre with like 100-120 people. And then we got booked to do a gig during Freshers Week the next year in the big hall in the students' accommodation, which Trinity College owned out in Dartry in Dublin. And we had an audience of 600 people, all fresh students, just arrived, sat out in chairs in a hall that they had erected a stage in. And it was lovely. They were very excited and happy to be there. And as freshers often are, trying really hard to just be very nice to people who were already in the university.
Lots of freshers trying to yes and, most of them no butting.
Yes. But we did ask for a name of an animal to inspire something. And someone said, duck. And we said, oh, why did you pick duck? Is it your favourite animal? They said, no, it's because it's both a noun and a verb. And so just an astute audience member suggestion was just really pleasing to me. Maybe we'll find out what our guest's favourite improv moment is in a second. Let me introduce
our
guest.
Maybe we will.
Or maybe we won't. Maybe we end the podcast here. Our guest this week is a comedian, improviser and self-described professional idiot, so it'll be good for us amateur idiots to watch and learn. She hails from Edinburgh, where she is almost annually to be seen at the Fringe, appearing with her acclaimed improv troupe, The Spontaneous Players. Their shows include Spontaneous Sherlock and, when that IP dried up, Spontaneous Potter.
Accurate.
A massive cynic. I'm glad you said that he's accurate.
And then Spontaneous Potter appeared, a month-long run of which sold out entirely at the Gilded Balloon at the Edinburgh Fringe and won them a Scottish Comedy Award. With the Players, she has toured the UK variously pretending to be a witch, Victorian detective and whatever else the moment demands, making audiences laugh alongside guests from other acclaimed improv companies such as Showstopper and Baby Wants Candy. As a solo act, she is often to be found at Monkey Barrel Comedy's Alternative Comedy Night, The Other Show, which is how we normally refer to no such thing as a fish on this podcast. And best of all, she has somehow made playing games, specifically the social deduction game Blood on a Clock Tower, into a career path, appearing regularly on YouTube, playing it with the likes of Chris Grace, former guest of this show, and the lovely team at No Rolls Barred, also friends of this show, pretending to hunt down demons for money. In many ways, she is the Derek Acora of the improv world. It gives me great joy to welcome Mara Joy.
Ah, oh, thank you, Barry. Oh. And thank you, Ben. Hello.
Lovely to see you.
Lovely to be here. All of what you said is true.
Yes. You've done a lot of those things.
I would do Sherlock every day if it wasn't for the fact that after the BBC stopped showing the show, people stopped buying tickets. So we had to switch. We simply had to.
Just had to pivot to J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, and I get paid a lot of money, and she doesn't, and that's good.
Yeah. Obviously, you've been improvising for a long, long time. Do you have a favourite moment that you've enjoyed in those times?
Oh, my gosh. With some of the Spontaneous Players, or two of them, I do a show which isn't as well-known or well-toured, where we do a show called Chuckle Improv. Which is an improvised Chuckle Vision episode. And,
now, I'm immediately going to have to stop you to ask you to explain the Chuckle Brothers and Chuckle Vision to our non-UK listeners.
Okay. So, how we explain it to our often international audiences is it's like a children's sitcom, like Friends, but they drive around in a special mobile. the Chuckle Mobile. But basically, it's two brothers, Paul and Barry Chuckle, not their real names, you'll be shocked to learn, who...
What?
I know. The real names are...
I thought it was a common name in Lancashire.
Each week or every day or however long it was on for like 23 years.
Yeah.
It's, I think, the longest running sitcom in UK history, which is mad. But basically, they were asked to do a certain task, which they would then fail to do so in a comedic fashion. So what we do when we do Chuckle Improv is we do that, but we also murder our friend Paul repeatedly.
Great. So he's sort of the Kenny of the situation.
Yeah, he plays, like, because I play Paul Chuckle, my friend Will plays Barry Chuckle, and Paul plays everybody else.
Amazing.
And basically it's become a running thing that whenever he comes on stage, there's a sort of counter over his character's head as to when something horrible will happen to him. The stupidest one of those we did was when we started World War One. because we stumbled upon a time machine,
right.
And Paul and Barry Chuckle accidentally killed the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. It was a whole thing.
That's amazing.
That's probably my favourite thing I've done in improv.
I'm here for you doing an improv show which is based around an even less well known BBC IP, which was cancelled even further ago in time.
Absolutely, and doing it in front of confused American tourists who are here for an improv festival. Yeah. Going, I don't know what that was, but I think I liked it.
That's so good. Talk briefly about Blood on the Clock Tower. We've enjoyed some games of Blood on the Clock Tower together, and
that's how I got to know Barry.
Yeah.
Joining him in murder. Joined by murder. But yeah, it's just a weird thing. I think it's sort of parallel to doing improv. Being good at games where you lie to people sort of seems to make sense to me. And somehow, confusingly, due to people I knew, some people asked me to do it on a YouTube channel, and now I more regularly get paid to go and play it or run it for people, and that's very weird.
Don't reflect on that. Just accept what the universe has given you.
Yeah. Yeah, I explained to my parents that I was the special guest at a board game convention, which is a thing they didn't know existed.
Yeah. But I love that the thing is, like, can you imagine? I'm sure, well, like, you can because you're living it, but your entire your life is devoted to, you know, being the best improviser you can and making people laugh and crafting things on stage. And then you happen to also be a fan of one particular board game, and that is probably what you are best known for.
It's a very strange thing.
Yeah.
Like Ben says, I try not to reflect on it too much because it would drive you mad.
Yeah. enjoy your years of fame now in this one little niche of the internet.
This one incredible micro celebrity in the most specific field possible. It's going with the flow is something I should be good at, and yet it terrifies me every time.
Oh, well, before your nerves get the best of you on the podcast, we should help break the ice by asking you what you are worst at in the world.
What am I worst at in the world? I would say resting, not relaxing. Relaxing I can do. Well, how to phrase that? I can do nothing, but that, which some people would call resting and relaxing, but it's not really that. It's more just a series of time where I'm sitting there and I'm not doing anything, but I'm doing a million things. Do you understand?
Yes.
Yeah.
No off switch. Yeah. Internal off switch.
Yeah. It doesn't exist. ADHD does not allow it. I don't quite... When people sort of have that set for a thing where they go, just, you know, empty your mind. I'm like, I don't understand what you mean. Meditation is a lie.
please release a self-help book with that title.
I am absolutely with that. I do not think it is possible for me to empty my mind.
Even and further.
Thank you, Barry.
A distressing and disgusting amount of very, very rich CEOs and business people studied improv in college, and it really infuriates me. Because I think there are two types of improviser. The types of improviser who continue to work in the arts, either as improvisers or within theatre generally. And then there are those who go on to be enormously successful business people, and there's no midpoint, it seems. Larry Page, Jack Dorsey, Eric Schmidt of Google, Arianna Huffington, have all done improv.
Oh, no.
And worst of all, Howard Schultz of tax-avoiding Starbucks. come at me,
Is that
come
their
at me,
full
mermaids.
Corporate name?
That's the full, the full corporate company is Tax Avoiding Starbucks LLC.
And were they all in the same improv group?
Oh, can you imagine?
Gross.
Howard Schultz said, improv taught me the importance of being present, listening actively, and responding truthfully, brackets, except when it comes to tax returns.
There you go, yeah.
I had a little look at famous moments from films that came out of improvisation. Maybe one of the best known ones is Here's Johnny from The Shining.
Yeah.
Johnny Carson used to introduce. Yes. Yeah. Johnny Carson's line on The Tonight Show, Jack Nicholson argued to have it in the film, and suffice to say, there was debate with Stanley Kubrick about whether he should do it or not, but eventually he managed to argue to keep it in. Gene Wilder asked for a cane for Willy Wonka when he played him in the film. And the director wasn't sure why until he saw him do the triple somersault when he came out of the factory, and I was like, "Oh yeah, no, that's fine."
He doesn't do a triple somersault.
Forward roll.
He said, "Go forward roll."
Forward roll. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think there was a thing I read that he insisted on the forward roll because he was like, "You need to know. You have no idea what this man is going to do next, and you need to like not trust him, but in a benevolent way."
Yeah. Good trickster type.
Yeah.
And one of my favourite ones, I literally just watched this film last week, and it's a great moment, is Emily Blunt's character in The Devil Wears Prada says, "Yeah, I'm hearing this," moving hands as if someone's mouth is talking, "I want to hear this," closed hand. And she said she heard a mom in a shop shouting at her kid that line, and saw it and was like, "Oh, this character in this film, I can so use that," and brought it into work, and so she went and put it in the movie. Yeah, it's a really good observation.
I shall be using that in all further parenting.
Yeah. Given your kids are studying puppetry at the moment, or they've been talking about puppetry, doing the hand puppet maneuver, yeah. I'm hearing hand puppet, and I want to hear marionette.
Yeah.
I read about the longest improvisation. There are some friends of mine have recently just been involved in the 48-hour improvathon down in Southend.
I've still never done an improvathon, but they sound like hell.
Yeah.
The same. I've been really would like to do it, but I remember talking years ago to Carrie Ad Lloyd, and her talking about, she'd been involved in the improv for at least 18 hours, and basically she had to be carried off stage delirious because she'd gone in too deep.
I think I remember her talking about once she was ended up in a scene, and she walked on stage and she was like, "Are these my friends? Do I know these people? Where am I?"
Oh no!
And then they're like, "Ha ha, funny." And she's like, "No, I think I'm dying."
You've all come to meet me at the pearly gates. Well, if you think 48 hours is long, in 2015, a 7-day show took place at the Improv Olympic West. Which was created by Rob O'Connor and Keith Salter-Janes, the longtime performers.
Oh, I know Keith.
Do you know Keith? Great. Well, yeah. There you go. They hold the world record for the longest continuous improv show at 150 hours. Now, they were not on stage for the 150 hours. It was a rotating cast. And they did it very smartly. They basically had 600 performers contributing from the likes of Second City and the Groundlings and Upright Citizens Brigade, Nerdist, Improv LA, all the big improv theatres across North America. And they performed in pre-scheduled blocks, and once one time slot was finishing, the next group would get on stage, joining the departing group in the final scene, and then the departing group would slowly find a way to exit the scene. So it was a continuous show with a sort of a rolling cast, if you like. And they continued for 150 hours straight through, 24 hours a day, no stopping for new suggestions or new teams, and then Rob and Keith came on to join it for the final hour again for the world record. And they started with a suggestion via phone call of the words "space-time continuum" by Improv Olympic founder Charna Halpern. So who to improvisers and comedians will be very well known, and probably not very well known outside of the industry. Charna Halpern was the partner of Del Close, and they founded the Improv Olympic, one of the great improv chains across America. But they began teaching The Harold, which is one of the most famed long-form improv shows. Del Close died in 1999, and Charna Halpern bequeathed his skull to the Goodman Theatre at his request, and then had to reveal a few years later that actually the skull was purchased online because the mortician refused to remove Dalclose's head. No butting his suggestion, which he would have been furious about. But the likes of, you know, Mike Myers and lots of SNL alumni and people will all have trained either with or in the vein of Dalclose and Charna Halpern. But then I began to look at outside of comedy for my world's worst improvisation. And I looked at musical improvisations. I had a look at some of the longest recorded guitar solos. And I looked at,
that's
recorded.
A great shout.
It is, isn't it? But obviously, live versions of guitar solos go on for hours and hours sometimes. But the longest ones on disc I could find were Fade to Black by Metallica, 1 minute 55, sorry. Led Zeppelin's Dazed and Confused, 1 minute 30. You've Hotel California, that's quite a famous one, the Eagles, 2 minutes and 15 seconds.
But this is, hang on, this is in the, like, the album track. Because obviously, yes. The Eagles are abysmal apart from that wrong one song.
Yes.
I mean, like 90 seconds and that guitar solo was great. Jimmy Page doing 90 seconds, terrific.
Yeah, you can deal with that.
I've read about Dave Gilmour of Pink Floyd doing guitar solos like 6, 7, 8 minutes long live and being like, God, I've got to do the shopping tonight and then I have to take the kids to school. Just ignoring what's happening.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, U2's performance of Desire at Live Aid, I think they just ended up doing that for about 15 minutes because Bono started dancing with a woman in the front row. we're still going, I heard it through the grapevine. That's 4 minutes and 52 seconds. That's on the recorded. So, I mean, obviously, like I say, the recorded ones are locked in time and the live ones go on for much, much longer. But then there is a world record for the longest ever guitar solo set in 2012 by an Austin musician, David DiDonato, who played nonstop for 25 hours and 55 minutes.
How long?
25 hours and 55 minutes. He could have done the last 5 minutes and got to the 26 hours. Yes, you're right. He was lazy.
And then he was removed from the guitar shop.
Yeah. Well, no, he did it at home and he did it online. He streamed it.
Oh.
So people could watch. And he had been...
Did he not have to stop for, like, bathroom breaks?
No,
or?
No. Well, he... hang on, I have the stuff about it here. His wife was a nurse. So she was great. She kept bringing him food and stuff. And afterwards, she was able to, like, give him stuff to ice. To ice himself and tell him how to look after himself. And he managed to do it nonstop, aided by the fact he had several guitars and he plugged a 7-string guitar into a bass amp so he could strum it and make it do a drone. So if for some reason he needed to like change an instrument or like rest a finger for a moment, he could still have a guitar sound playing throughout all of this. He's 5 different guitars.
Literally leave the room and come back.
Yes.
Yeah, that seems like a bit of a cheat.
Yes, yeah, Guinness. Well, this is the scandal. We're here to take this down.
We're taking this back.
Yeah.
He didn't even do the full 26 hours.
No,
he
didn't do the full 26 hours. Yeah, he had 40,000 people tuning in during his live stream, though. I didn't... Whatever about whether you agree with the being able to strum and have that continue for a bit, the thing I didn't like is he did a couple of things where he pretended he was going to pass out. And he was purely doing that to play up to the watching audience.
Like James Brown when he pretends to be not have enough energy yet and requires the crowd to get him back on his feet again.
He needs his cape again.
Or it's kind of like the sort of David Blaine vibe of like, oh, am I going to fail at this? And you're like, you fought this all through. Yeah, you know you can do this.
But my world's worst improvisation, I have found a piece of music by friend of the show, John Cage.
There it is.
It's called Organ Squared, or ASLSP, or As Slow As Possible. And it is the subject of the second longest lasting musical performance yet undertaken. Now, John Cage had written a piece in 1985 for piano, and he adapted it in 1987 for organ. Now, the piano version usually lasts between 20 and 70 minutes. An organ is playing the organ version of it in the St. Bukhardi Church in Halberstadt. It began playing in 2001, and the performance is due to end in the year 2640. It is. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is the longest running non-computerized piece of music currently being performed. The most recent note, if you're curious, was played a few weeks ago on February the 5th. And the next note will be played on August the 5th, 2026.
I think if there's 2 years in between notes, it's not a song.
So let me give you a bit
of... Maybe that's controversial.
Yeah, you know, John Cage isn't around to refute it. His silence, in many ways, is deafening on the subject.
No, his silence is musical.
Yeah.
Yes. All 4 minutes and 32 seconds of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's so there is a recorded version of it. There are several recorded versions of it, in fact.
What do you mean?
So the piece of music is 8 pages long, but it's written in an open format, so you can basically make the notes last as long as you like. There's no time signature, if you like. And the thing I love about this most of all is the music begins with a rest. So actually, the piece of music...
I'm sorry, like, can we just accept that John Cage is basically the Simon Munnery of classical music?
Yeah. One of the greatest comedians of all time.
How far he could push it and go, are they going to go with this? So they are.
Yeah. To give you some context, the music in the Halberstadt performance began on September the 5th, 2001, with the rest. So actually the first pipe was played February the 5th, 2003. 18 months later. It's so clever. There have been other recorded performances of it, as I say. There was a version of it recorded in 2009, which lasted 14 hours and 56 minutes. It's been streamed on YouTube. There was a 24-hour version of it performed on the Twitch channel All Request Live. Steve Whittington performed an 8-hour version of it at the Elder Hall Organ for John Cage Day in 2012. 3 organists combined for a 12-hour team performance at Christchurch Cathedral in Montreal in 2015. And I like this one. A composer called Frank Felice orchestrated and recorded an electronic version of it in 2015-2016. The performance was delivered online to an iPhone app, and a 35-second snippet of it was basically posted every day for a year. So you got it was played in portions, and then the whole 3.5-hour realization was played as a final performance at a festival.
It was released the way Dickens would release his novels.
In many ways, yes. Yeah. The second slowest performance of it, and the longest complete performance, was a 16-hour performance by Christopher Anderson on March the 8th, 2022, at a chapel in America. But that one was completed. So now this one is still ongoing. And lots of musicians and philosophers discussed the instruction to play as slow as possible at a conference in 1997, because a pipe organ that's well maintained, that could sound indefinitely. So the John Cage Organ Foundation at Halberstadt decided on a 639-year performance, because that was the time between the first documented permanent organ installed at the cathedral in 1361 and the original proposed start date in the year 2000. They actually started a year late. But they had a lack of money, because that was what delayed the thing starting. And the chord changes of the first part, which end in 2072, were calculated by Christoph Bossert and Rainer O. Neugebauer. And it's played by sandbags, basically pressing the pedal. They depress the pedals to maintain the notes. And it's very funny. You can go on the Wikipedia page for it, and you can hear one of the note changes from a few years ago.
And just a plate applause.
Yeah, there is an audience out there waiting for the note to change. And they've built this organ specifically for it. It's in the church's right transept. The bell is in the left transept. And until 2011, acrylic glass encased it to reduce the volume of it, because it's just continually playing this music. What else did I like about it? They installed new pipes as the tone becomes more complex, and the bellows can provide this constant supply of air, so it can keep playing. At the last note change, I said, was on February the 5th, and the performance, as I said, is going to end in September 2640. And the first 65 impulses of presses and release will take 70 years, with the shortest gap between notes, if you're wondering, being 30 days in the year 2034.
That's going to be a big year.
That's a big year. In fact, I think it's 31 days and then 30 days between notes that year.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, so many questions. Question number one is, like, did he just compose this completely arbitrarily? And he just went, yeah, we'll have 30 days and 31 days, then a couple of years, then maybe a B flat, and then maybe a sustained pedal. And he's just throwing out ideas. The second and more important thing, wouldn't it be wonderful if when it finishes in 26, whatever, that if we still have music reviewers around at that stage, someone writes down derivative, one star.
Yeah. Yeah. venue was called.
One family of critics has to pass down the review from generation to generation.
And in 200 years, we're like, we don't even remember why this started.
Yes.
But I know, I've got a note in the diary to go to Halberstadt in 4 years' time, and I don't know why.
Wars have been fought over this diary.
Empires have risen and fallen in the years intervening. So I've picked up some worse improvisation, because essentially he's written it with the freedom to interpret it at any pace you like. So this particular improvisation, I think, given that no one is going to see the end of it, because the world will have ended, I'm sure.
It's also meticulously planned for an improvisation. It's simultaneously, oh, we're going to do what we like, but also it will be
planned
exactly
to the ground. Yeah.
18 months. Yeah. Exactly this.
I picked As Slow As Possible by John Cage.
Wow.
Very good. What irritating bollocks.
I, like Barry, I went down the same route of looking at films where people had improvised lines, but the thing is, that's all good stuff, because you can edit it out, so if it's bad, they just get rid of it, right? When Humphrey Bogart says, "He is looking at you, kid," which apparently is not in the script, everyone goes, "Oh, that's a good line," and now it's like on AFI's like list of like top quotes of all time. And
how
it's just
annoyed
thing that he said.
How annoyed would the script or the screenwriter be?
Yeah. Well, that's why I always think about that, because I've written stuff before, and I've obviously improvised stuff before, and I often wonder if the writers of these big Hollywood films are like, that people go, "Oh, the best moment in that film, the best moment in The Dark Knight, is the moment where Heath Ledger claps along," yeah. And it's like, but the writer must be like, I didn't. What do you mean the best moment? What do you mean? It's not. I didn't do that.
Yeah.
So I started thinking about. Initially I was thinking about how improv is like being quick on your feet and being able to respond to stuff. And the first thing that came to my head when thinking about being quick on your feet in films was the ultimate not doing that, which is Marlon Brando in The Island of Dr. Moreau, which I then found out that you have already discussed on this podcast.
Oh, we've dismantled that.
So I went back and listened to that.
Yeah. What a mess. But remind our listeners, because it's been a while since we talked about it, and it is an absolute mess.
So much stuff going on in that film. It went through two directors. The original director went mad, lived in a hut for a while, then snuck back onto the set of the film. but the thing about Marlon Brando was, at this stage of his career, he no longer cared about anything.
No.
So he would have he had an earpiece in that would so he'd have the script's lines being recited to him, but sometimes there would be interference, and famously apparently once during a scene he was in the middle of a monologue and just said, "There's been a break in at a Woolworths," which is
sure,
because the police band came in instead. That's just
right.
It takes a lot of, you have to be pretty bad at improvisation to like be, "Oh, clearly this is the thing I meant to say." I decided to look away from there because obviously you discussed it before, so I started trying to find examples of the worst improvised lines that were kept in the film.
Ooh.
There's a line in the movie Blade where Blade says, "Some motherfucker's always trying to ice skate uphill." That's technically not improvised. However, it is a thing that David Goyer, the writer of the film, heard Wesley Snipes say to an accountant and went, "Okay, I'm putting that in the film."
As well as the beautiful detail there.
Detail, yeah.
He was on the phone to his accountant, apparently. And again, Wesley Snipes and accountants as a whole thing. We will So I like that. But I think the best example is, have either of you seen the film Shark Attack 3? Megalodon.
No, I've seen Shark Attack 1 and 2.
You beat me to it, Barry. I'm actually on production of my own self-funded Shark Attack 4.
Okay.
Well, too Shark, Too Furious.
Shark Attack 3 Megalodon is a film that I have seen.
Oh no, Mara, please.
Well, it became quite famous on the internet around about in the early 2000s. It came out in 2002, and it became quite famous for one scene in particular. Which I'll get into, but before that, I actually I've prepared a short quiz, if that's okay.
Oh yes,
lovely. Yes.
Breaking with the format, but yes. I don't know how into like shark movies you guys are.
Great, I'm not at all, but I'd love a quiz nonetheless. So I'm ready to dive in feet first and be eaten.
I'm going to give you the names of 12 shark movies, and I want you to tell me which of these are not real.
Oh great.
Okay. So, first of all, you've got Big Shark.
Mm-hmm.
I love it, yes. Yes, true.
Okay. Jurassic Shark.
Absolutely.
Absolutely true.
Dino Shark.
Yep.
Yep, not a problem with that one.
Cocaine Shark.
Oh, now is that before or after Cocaine Bear?
Cocaine Bear.
Yeah. I mean, the question is that I have to ask is, would a shark take cocaine with its nostrils or through its gills?
That's why it doesn't want you to be punched in the nose, because it's already taken an enormous line.
Yeah.
Important thing.
No.
Ghost, okay. No, cocaine shark's not real. Cocaine shark is real.
Oh, is it?
Ghost
it is.
Shark? Yeah.
Ghost shark, yeah. Are these all going to be real, Mara? Is this the trick question?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes. Correct.
Don't red shark Mara like halfway through her saying this.
True.
Ghost Shark is true. It's about a shark that gets killed by a hunter, and then its ghost comes back to kill its family. I've seen that.
Superb.
One.
Superb.
Yeah. Snow Shark, colon, ancient snow beast.
I'm so here for the fact that the word snow appears twice in that title.
Yeah. It's also one of several avalanche shark-based movies I found out about.
I mean, that's the natural enemy of the famously aquatic shark, is the avalanche.
Please tell me it has scenes of a fin going through the snow.
Of course it does.
Of course it does.
There's also another film called Snow Shark, which is not this film, which is a sequel... or a parallel sequel to the film Sand Shark, which I've not got on this list.
Wow.
Jaws in Japan?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's real. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like a Bing Crosby and Bob Hope travel movie extravaganza.
If you're wondering how did they not get sued for calling their film Jaws in Japan, they did. and later changed it to the name Psycho Shark.
Great.
House Shark.
And we're sued by the Talking Heads.
Yeah.
House Shark. Is house that what shark. They just find a shark in their bathtub?
No, shark. It's a home invasion, but it's a shark.
Amazing. Right. Up the toilet.
The tagline is: "You're going to need a bigger house."
oh no!
I mean, how they avoided litigation off that is remarkable.
I disagree. I think the larger your house is, the more room there is for the shark to maneuver around. If you're in a small house, it's going to be thrashing it. It'll be wild, but it's not going to be able to like have the freedom of movement it has in the ocean. A big house, possibly with like a swimming pool, is absolute catnip to a shark.
I was also reading how that film
Sharknip,
came about.
Sharknip, please.
Sharknip,
yes. Oh, sorry. House Shark came about because there was ice found in the director's house. And he went, oh, it'd be interesting if there was, like, zombies encased in the ice. And he went, actually, I don't want to make a zombie movie. I'll make a shark movie. So this is the kind of geniuses that we're looking at. I've got a couple more. A trilogy of Two-Headed Shark Attack.
Yeah, love it.
That's a Queen song, isn't it?
Yeah. Followed by Three-Headed Shark Attack. Yeah. And can you guess what the third film is called?
Please tell me it's Four-Headed Shark Attack.
No, it's Five-Headed Shark Attack.
They got funding for that one. Yeah, they were able to afford the extra heads.
I don't know why they didn't go for four. It blows my mind. The final one I've got here is the incredibly named Sharkansaw Women's Prison Massacre.
What? Oh, that is a really... aching pun. I can hear all of the internal parts creaking on
shark
that.
And it's the state sign for Arkansas, but SH is written in blood in front of it. It is part of the Slumber Party Massacre universe, which I didn't know existed until looking into this.
Slumber Massacre.
Slumber Party Massacre, yeah. Wow. All of those shark films exist, and many more that I didn't mention. Obviously, there are much more famous, like Mega Shark.
So good. I'm going to add that to the stupid bookmark I have on my internet browser alongside films with the word versus in the title.
There's Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
Yes.
As part of that, yeah. Straddles both.
Straddles both genres, yes.
Yeah. The reason Shark Attack 3 became infamous has nothing to do with the sharks, weirdly. The shark effects in it are bad. Mm. And there's a great bit where somebody jet skis into the mouth of a giant shark. that's great. But the reason it's infamous is because this film stars John Barrowman.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And he improvised a line of dialogue that has become absolutely infamous, which is where he turns to the female lead. They've survived some shark attacks, and she's like, "Oh wow, I'm really tired." And he's like, "Yeah, but I'm kind of wired." And then he says the infamous line, "What do you say? I take you home and eat your pussy."
Oh dear.
Oh.
That is a line of dialogue that John Barrowman says in that film.
I just want to be very clear. John Barrowman was not playing a shark who wanted to eat a cat.
No, he's playing a man who is talking to his love interest in this film. And that is the line of dialogue he says with as much energy as I delivered it with, as much pizzazz, as much like charisma as I delivered it with. And then immediately hard cuts to them having sex in a shower.
Oh my God. Yeah. I think John Barrowman trying so hard to play straight and overcompensating.
Exactly. Yes. Her reaction as well is incredible. She does not blink. She's like, oh. And it's an entirely improvised line. Like, that he was just... Basically, the director went, we want something that will get a reaction. He was like, oh, I'll do something for the blooper reel. No, it's in the film.
Oh, no.
It's in the movie. You can watch it. Although, I believe... I believe in TV versions of the film, it's the line is changed to, "What do you say? I take you home and watch I Love Lucy."
That's even worse.
Yeah.
Take you home, watch I Love Lucy.
I feel personally assaulted by this.
It's terrible. And he improvised it, and it stays in the film. It stays in the picture.
I love the fact that presumably in the TV version he says, "What about I take you home when we watch I Love Lucy?" Hard cut to them having sex in the shower.
Yeah, it's like with you're not watching I Love Lucy at all.
With I Love Lucy on in the background.
Yeah.
Growing up, one of my favourite things to do was to listen to jazz with my dad. Good, proper, unpretentious jazz. Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, Billy Elliot, Anita O'Day, Sarah Vaughan. Gorgeous, classical, pumped up, big band, warm jazz. And as jazz goes on through the 50s and 60s, the jazz musicians have a bit of a competition to see how many notes they can fit into a bar at pace, and you get things like bebop and hard bop. And then in the late 60s and early 70s, you've already had a bit of jazz fusion, and then something called free jazz comes along.
Yeah.
And free jazz, pioneered by the likes of people called Ornette Coleman, is jazz that considers things like melody a bit too limiting, and can best be described as containing atonal improvisation. Now, I don't want to suggest that I want to limit someone's creative vision, because there are early progenitors of this, Thelonious Monk amongst them, whose piano playing skill can best be described as, but what if a cat played it? or Sun Ra.
Hang on, the Arrest of Cats has taught me that cats are very good at the piano.
Yes, very strong point. Yes, this is an untutored cat who did not go to a conservatoire.
Felinius Monk.
No, oh my god!
Nothing
yes,
there. There's nothing there.
There's no nothing whatsoever. There's also Sun Ra, who is sort of the answer to the question: what would happen if George Clinton went down the road marked jazz instead of funk? And I like him, but Ornette Coleman, it's such unlistenable shit. It really is. It's the stuff that gives jazz a bad name, and it's easy to slag off jazz. I know. I mean, God, the three of us know, like, bad comedy improv is horrible to watch.
Like, as someone who's done some terrible comedy improv,
it's because the thing is, like, bad stand-up isn't great. It isn't fun. But sometimes it can be a good death is fun to watch. And the thing with bad stand-up, you can get involved, you can heckle, you can make it stop.
And also with bad stand-up, for the person on stage, a joke's gone badly, okay, they know we've got another one coming up in a bit. Bad improv, you're on stage and you can feel it dying and you have to write the next joke or the next moment as you're sinking.
This set is an hour long and it's not going well 5 minutes in. Yeah. And... I'm here for another 55 minutes.
Let's not play it for laughs. Let's play it dead serious and try and pass it off as a drama.
But the worst thing with bad comedy improv, bad stand-up, the worst kind of bad stand-up is someone who's dying but thinks they're killing.
Yeah.
At least with one person, it's like, you, sir or madam, are deluded. But when it's an entire group of people all egging each other on, and yet still, some of Ornette Coleman's work... is so cacophonously awful. It's like being assailed by a bunch of tone-deaf elephants with learning difficulties.
Yeah.
It is... I'm just like, can you not play a nice tune? It's all I ask of them. Like, I like challenging music. I like difficult music. I'll listen to Lou Reed being grumpy. I'll enjoy a bit of Stockhausen. I mean, I say I'll enjoy a bit of Stockhausen. I've listened to 30 seconds and gone, ugh.
I'll tolerate a bit of Stockhausen.
I understand what you're trying to do, but no.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's so much I understand what you're trying to do. I listened to the first Velvet Underground album. Not the first one, the third one with the banana on it. Some beautiful tracks on it, but, you know, God, Heroin and Venus and Furs are a bit fucking much. But the older I've got, the more I can, like, get it.
Yeah.
But this... My problem with free jazz is... My favourite thing about jazz is it's fun. It's fun and it's sprightly and exciting.
Infamously, yeah.
Yeah. And free jazz is just... awful wailing. It falls into the same place as the bits of modern art where you're like, oh, I could probably do that. As ever, as the famous phrasing go, talking or writing about music is like dancing about architecture. So...
Yes.
It's hard to, because obviously, my wife is not into music, and so for her, it's either got to have a beautiful tune or be preferably happy, bouncy music. And if I'm going to listen to something that doesn't fall under that remit on my own, I don't mind if it's challenging or odd or difficult or takes a few listens. Like, even, like, bless him, Andre 3000's latest album that he released this year, which is like an hour and 10 minutes of jazz flute, which... no one needs, but I'm glad he did it.
Because it stops him doing something else.
Yeah. He needed to get it out of his system, and it's good for him.
It's not as good as anything that Outkast have done, but I like that he's gone there. But it's not... Yeah. I guess the thing is, he's not... Sometimes boundaries need to be pushed, and you get to somewhere interesting with it. Andre's not doing that. He's just having a lovely time with his flute. But Ornette Coleman is like...
He saw Lizzo and got jealous.
Yeah, excuse me. That. He's riding... Ornette Coleman is riding towards the border, shirtless, yelling and brandishing a sharpened clarinet, and I will not have it.
The way you talk about it reminds me of how many times have you went to see like an experimental theatre show and you've been like, no, you didn't need to do this.
Yeah.
This didn't need to happen.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And it's just like somebody wearing, like, dressed in tinfoil and hitting themselves in the head with this is a genuine thing I saw at the Fringe once, hitting themselves in the head with a colander. And I was like, I'm not sure, I don't know what this is. I don't know why you're doing it. I don't think you should be doing it. I guess it's technically art.
Mm.
Yeah.
I reckon they found a kitchen supplies shop that was having a closing down sale.
Yeah, and they already booked the venue.
Yeah, so they booked the venue. Yeah. But that's what we've got.
I think stuff like, whenever I see performance art like that, I'm like, either you need a better therapist or a lover who is more understanding of your kink.
Preferably not both in one. Yeah.
Oh, now. Do I want to put on a show called The Kinky Therapist? Probably not. Probably not. We're going to go back to the world of music for my selection. But before we do that, we're going to go off to the world of the military, because I found out something remarkable. I want to talk to you about a psychologist who worked with the Office of Strategic Service. He's a chap called Yuri Brofenbrin, a Russian-American psychologist. He was looking at all sorts of stuff about using various different frameworks in which to understand human psychology. He's done a lot of stuff on child psychology. He is, by all accounts, an incredibly august intellectual. But I found an article that talked about his work with the American military and the OSS, like I said, which is the precursor of the CIA, during World War II. Because when they were recruiting people for the special ops services, they did all sorts of research on them. And they would do things like raw IQ tests. They would measure their adaptability. And one thing that he put forward was getting them to do improv to see how creative they were and how they would adapt to stressful situations. In 1948, long before any of the improv schools that we know about, he was influenced by the work of a chap called Jacob Moreno, who created the notion of psychodrama, which was first staged at an improv theatre ensemble in New York City in the 1920s. The best improv scenarios that they could work with, they discovered, were ones that were relatively free structuring, departed from a real-life role, and focused on classical conflict situations, which is, you know, things that we sort of recognise from improv. So this chap created scenarios to put potential special ops in. It's not ideal. So scenario 1A, the first actor is Mr. Thomas, the superintendent of schools, and the second is Mr. Green, a high school teacher. Mr. Thomas is told that Mr. Green is 35 years old and is a bachelor, and you've heard persistent rumours regarding Mr. Green's sexual conduct. Scene. Yep, here comes another one. Scenario 3B. Both actors receive the same instructions. Mary and Dick have been going around together for over a year. Whenever you're alone and you find yourself becoming more and more intimate, things have reached a point where there are no holds barred. You've been thinking about this and you decide to talk about it in private. So basically, he made them do psychodrama improvs, but with a heavily sexualized element. And with a lot of classic American 1940s, I forgot the phrase, but a bit like Pink Threat stuff, with a lot of undertones of homosexuality in them, to see how members of the future CIA would react to this dangerous destabilizing influence.
But we've got to make sure that in this improvised scene that they act in the way that a red-blooded heterosexual man would.
Precisely so. So
don't want them sitting, buying the woman a cocktail and dishing all their gossip.
What's interesting is I've seen those scenes in student improv like recently. So that's
they always recruit. They recruit. You know, famously, MI6 are recruiting from Cambridge and Oxford. So maybe they're looking. They're auditioning. Wow. They're auditioning for the Secret Service.
Maybe.
But I've got someone in. I've got someone in. Can we do a Mary and Dick scene?
Yeah.
But for my suggestion, we're going back to the world of jazz and experimental jazz. And one things that jazz musicians like to do as part of the world of free jazz was create instruments or introduce instruments that were not necessarily from the jazz world. So let me introduce you to Rufus Harley Jr., born in North Carolina, and he moved with his mum to North Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. And he began at the age of 12 with the saxophone, and he played the trumpet. And by the age of 22, he was studying the saxophone, the flute, the oboe, and the clarinet, alongside a guy called Dennis Sandahl, who taught some of the greats, like John Coltrane and Pat Martino. Mm. However, he was inspired to learn a new instrument after seeing it used during John F. Kennedy's funeral procession in November 1963.
Because during his assassination.
It's like, oh, that rifle looks like it'd make a very nice knife.
The Zapruder film is an instructional video.
So, Mara and Barry, what instrument did Rufus Harley Jr. decide to bring into the world of jazz?
I feel like it simply must be the bagpipes.
You are 100% right, my love. Yeah. It must be the bagpipes. The jazz bagpipe.
Because Kennedy strikes me as the kind of person who definitely had a paper playing at his funeral.
The Black Watch were performing there. With,
there you go.
So, he was at the time, he was a maintenance worker for Philadelphia's Housing Authority, so he had to search Philadelphia for a set of bagpipes. Couldn't find a set of bagpipes in Philadelphia. So he moved to New York, where he found a set in a pawn shop, which he bought for $120, which is a hell of a lot of money in 1960.
Sorry. I'm so sorry. Someone has relocated, not for like, oh, it's, you know, why have you moved here? It's for work. Oh, to be closer to my partner. I've moved here for the bagpipes.
Yeah, I need bagpipes. And I cannot get them delivered.
Did not choose Scotland.
I know. Well, I mean, it's quite hard to get from Philadelphia to Scotland in the early 1960s.
That's fair. But, wow. To be so driven by the sound of bagpipes to be like, this is my calling. This is what I must do.
I have to say here, I think I've mentioned before, my mum, when she was a baby, has a really vivid memory of jumping out of her mother's arms because some bagpipe music came on the radio.
On the radio? Yeah. Not even nearby.
Yeah.
It's astonishing. So this is far and away my favourite bit of his story. So on several occasions when a neighbour called the police to complain about Harley's practising his bagpipes in his home, he would quickly put away the bagpipes, feign ignorance, asking the officers, "Do I look like I'm Irish or Scottish to you?" Just, however, when he performed, he would perform in full regimental regalia. I mean, the image of this black guy from North Carolina in the kilt and the regimental hat playing jazz bagpipes.
In 1960s New York.
It's wonderful, isn't it? And sometimes he wouldn't go for the full Scottish regalia. He'd, I don't know, I guess take it back far into your history, Mara. He'd have the kilt, he'd have the bagpipes, and he'd wear a Viking horned helmet.
Yeah, those are almost the same thing.
They are.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he recorded not one, not two, not three, but four bagpipe jazz albums. So
were they with four different labels?
No, all on Atlantic.
Under four different pseudonyms because he kept getting moved along by the police.
Yeah, wow.
I live in Edinburgh. I hear bagpipes on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean,
they can sometimes be a lovely sound.
Though they can when they are playing the correct thing. I mean, obviously the Red Hot Chili Pipers can get in the bin with like I mean, one of the worst sounds I've ever heard at the Edinburgh Festival was Coldplay's Clocks played on the bagpipes, which is just unacceptable.
I know which shop you're talking about. But there's a Scotland shop that exclusively plays bagpipe covers of popular music.
No. But just because it can be done doesn't mean it should be done.
Yeah, 100%. The Jeff Goldblum yes. moniker but holds to this. Like, I mean, there's the thing, a review that I read of it, basically it says that, you know, he is a brave man to try and play improvisational music using a drone instrument.
Yeah.
And what
I mean, which is funny given that my suggestion is being played on an organ.
Yeah, yeah.
And John Barrowman's capable yeah. of doing it. Hi. But yeah, I don't even know if it's possible to improvise under bagpipes.
It is, but you will be sucked into them and there is no escape. Our nominations for the world's worst improvisation are John Cage's interminable multi-century composition, As Slow As Possible, Mara's deeply problematic yes. acting improvisation from the classic Shark Attack 3 by John, have you not been cancelled by now, Barryman, and my nomination of Rufus Harley in his own album's words, Scotch and Soul of the Jazz Bagpipes.
That sounds like a delicious dish in a mid-20th century London restaurant rather
yeah.
than...
Yeah, it does. Oh, I don't know, or kind of like an offer in a bar in Louisiana.
Yeah, Scotch and Soul.
Oh. Scotch and Soul, please. Wow.
Do you know what? I'm gonna discount Cage because he's got previous for this. Yeah. But,
and it is written, to be fair. The improvisation is just around how long people decide it's going to take.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not proper improv. So it's between...
But in that, yeah. In a way, doesn't that make it even worse? But yeah, yeah. No, yeah I
yes. They've had enough time to think about it done this.
They've written it through, but yeah, yeah. No, I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
And the thing is with Rufus Harley, I've got a sort of grudging respect for him. Like, and I think the Viking helmet, he can't be taking himself too seriously. Yeah.
Mm. I genuinely might go and try and listen to
do it. It should be an extra episode. Because it reminds me, there's a great guy that my dad used to play when I was young called Roland Kirk, who is a blind musician who used to play two saxophones and a nose flute at the same time. And there's a great tune of his called, I think it's called, might be called Jerry's Tune, but it's basically, it references the circus march in an improv.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, clearly he's having fun, he's taking the piss. And I'd like to, like, don't get me wrong, it's a joke that should have stopped after the first album, but your man's found his niche. Whereas the visceral reaction, frankly, all three of us had to what you said, Mara.
I knew I was going to say it, and it still happened.
Oh. Well, I mean, now we've been, since Shooty Gatto I got made Doctor Who, me and my wife have been rewatching old Doctor Who's, and I tell you what, rewatching Barrowman, like at the time it was like, oh, you're so dashing and charismatic, and now it's like, oh, this is quite creepy. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
So I think, you know.
I think creepy is subjective enough that you don't have to say allegedly.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, that's just your opinion.
Okay.
I think we can all agree John Barrowman was creepy.
It's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah.
Which we all, I think that's fair comment.
An absolute delight to have a dude reference there, considering I've already slagged off the Eagles. Well done, Mara. Yeah. So, before we go, time for the best news of the week, and we go to America, Georgia, Colorado, and Michigan. And I want to tell you about an American travel blogger called Corey Lee. Corey is a wheelchair user, but also still loves the great outdoors. And so Corey has sort of debuted a brand new all-terrain wheelchair that is the coolest thing I've seen in quite some time. It basically looks like Corey has... frankly, decapitated Johnny Five from Short Circuit and is sat where his body would be and is using the triangular off-road tracks. It is awesome. And you know those like off-road cars that look like they can basically ascend near vertical cliff faces?
Yeah.
That's what it looks like Corey could do. And so he can now travel around some of the most vertiginous national parks in America. And as he said to CNN, it'll open up a whole new world for me and for other wheelchair users. And it is the most badass piece of kit I've seen in a while. So
with the caterpillar wheels on it as well. Have you seen that one?
Yes.
Oh yeah, I imagine. I have different wheel attachments.
He's got caterpillar wheels and for what he's doing, deserts and sands and stuff. He's going to travel the world. Yeah. It's amazing.
It's like a real life Action Man like accessory. You know, I remember getting those toys and I'd be like, and now he's got a drill.
Yeah.
Yes, 100%.
That's so cool.
Now he's got Boadicea blades attached.
Just go for it. That's amazing.
Before we go, Mara, where can our listeners find you and what will they find you doing when they get there?
You can find me online at Marajoy Loves is where you can find things, where I talk about stuff that I love on Instagram or whatever. But also, like I say, come to the other show in Edinburgh. I'm usually there doing something stupid. And wherever the Spontaneous Players are performing, with Spontaneous Potter or Spontaneous Sherlock, come find those.
Tremendous. And you have a very silly titled solo show coming up, right?
I've got a solo show coming up March 18th at the Glasgow International Comedy Festival. I've got a show called Joy Genius, which is a stupid show with a stupid name.
took me a moment, but absolutely delightful. Well, we're all off to record several funk sitar albums. Until next time, thanks for listening to Worship Forward. Goodbye.
Bye.